I'm Danielle Kading, and you're listening to Hear Me Out on Wisconsin Public Radio. Many workers are getting ready to celebrate the long Labor Day weekend, and in this hour, we'll be talking about how much money most Wisconsin workers make and how that pales in comparison to the state's top earners. A new report says the richest 1% in Wisconsin made, on average, 19 times as much as everyone else in 2014. In northwestern Wisconsin, about 10 to 12% of all the income goes to the top 1%, and most people are making anywhere from $30,000 to $40,000 a year. Laura Dresser is Associate Director with the Center on Wisconsin Strategy in Madison, and she put that report together with the Wisconsin Budget Project. She spoke with me earlier this week by phone about their findings and what can be done to bridge the income gap.
We have national partners at the Economic Policy Institute who have used this national data set and generated for each state these measures of inequality. And so we could draw on that resource. And they had just updated the information at the state level. And so we were, that's the kind of technical reason. But the reason we would do this report at any time is Wisconsin is a state that's sort of been defined by a relatively high levels of equity. We aren't as unequal as most states. But the last 30 years have been decades of increasing inequality, both nationally and in Wisconsin. And Wisconsin is back to where we were in 1929. And I think documenting and paying attention to that level of inequality is the reason we did this report.
So people in Wisconsin currently are as well off as they were in 1929?
Oh, no. The disparity between the median income at the 99%, the average income for 99% of the population, everybody but the richest 1%, the average income there, the ratio comparing that number to the average income for the top 1%, that's the measure of inequality we look at. And that was in 1929 about 20 to 1. And it fell across through the New Deal and in the post-war period. It was sort of coming down, and then in the 1970s, that inequality began to lift, both in the U.S. and in Wisconsin. And so we're on this upward escalator of inequality. The U.S. is more unequal than we are, but we're going right up behind it and back up to the levels that were set in 1929. But it's a disparity measure, not a income value measure.
Wow. No, I mean, but that's quite a gap, though, right?
Yeah. I mean, if you look at 99% of the population, basically everyone, the average income in that population in the state is below $50,000. $48,000 is the average income for 99% of the population. And the average income for the top 1% of the population is $933,000 annual, and that's the measure of disparity we're looking at. As the economy has grown, more rewards have gone to the top. The remaining population has been largely stagnant.
Wow. Did you get from this report at all any indication of what's driving a lot of that inequality?
There are important stories about what's driving inequality in the United States economy and in Wisconsin. This does not uncover those stories as much, though certainly we know that changes in tax policy, changes in institutions that support workers at the bottom of the labor market, in the middle of the labor market, changes in the bargaining power of workers, all these things have mattered to income inequality. But this report is really more documenting the trend in the state than really unpacking exactly the sources.
Okay, so where in the state do we see kind of the widest gap between the, most of us, and the top 1%?
And everybody else? Well, the places that have the greatest gaps, I mean, one of the things that you can do with this data is actually look by county, and you can see the disparity in specific counties. So one of the things that drives inequality is having an urban area that generates a lot of income for, or that has some rich people. So, for example, the most unequal county, where the average income of the top 1% is actually many times well above that 19-to-1, is Eau Claire County. I can't give you why Eau Claire. Eau Claire is big, and maybe that's just Bon Iver. I don't know. Part of it is that what drives it is having some rich people. Having a lot of rich people matters. And so around the Milwaukee area, you can see very high disparity in Ozaukee and higher than state average, even in the city, in the county of Milwaukee, and in Waukesha counties, because you have, even though the average income of the bottom 99% is higher than the state average, the average income of the top 1% gets very high in those counties. That's where we have concentrations of very high income. So cities is part of it, and really in inequality, often what you're measuring is how high are the highs. That's what's driving inequality generally, is how high are the highs. And so across the state where you have concentrations of very rich people, you will have these higher disparity levels.
Okay. And so for, you know, areas of the state that don't see as big of a disparity between the 99 and the 1%, I mean, what are some of the best places, I guess, for closing that gap?
There's different things that close the gap, right? One is that the 99% have higher income, and you'd be interested in being in places where the 99% have higher income rather than lower income. Dane County, for example, the 99% have the among the highest income in the state. Also, St. Croix County, above $60,000 annually. You might want to think about places that have higher average income in the bottom 99%. That'd be one way to think about it. Then you would think also about lower disparity, but some of those kind of places with the very lowest disparity in the state, it's mostly because not only are the rich people less rich, but also the 99% have less income. That's the case in a county like Jefferson County or especially Iron County, where the average income of the bottom 99% is actually just $30,000, fully $18,000 annual fewer than the rest of the state, while the top 1% is also very low. So their disparity doesn't look that bad, right? But it's partly that the income across the board in that county is low.
Well, I mean, they also have one of the, or maybe the lowest population in the state as far as county residents, right?
Some of these ones are tiny, yeah. But in terms of, you know, you might not choose a county or thinking about, you know, a place to be just on the basis of having low disparity. You might choose it on what is the average for the 99%, and then you would end up sort of looking at those will be more urban counties or commuter counties. So Dane, St. Croix, the average income of the bottom 99% in Waukesha County is $75,000. I believe that's the highest in the state.
So why did you feel it was important to show people these results? I mean, what are you hoping people take away from these findings?
Well, I think inequality is a really serious challenge to the way we think about economic growth and society in a way. For a long time in that post-war period, as the economy grew, the rewards of that growth were evenly distributed. So it was sort of unambiguous that we wanted more growth, because growth meant that median incomes rose, that poverty declined, and that society moved together as the economy grew. What happens when you get a lot of inequality is that as the economy grows, the rewards to growth are distributed disproportionately or sometimes almost completely at the very top of the income distribution. And so instead of growing together as a society, you really pull apart. And create a kind of set of haves and have-nots and a kind of sense of a lack of a trajectory up with economic growth for the middle class. And that, I think, is a real problem, both in terms of trying to build a more inclusive economy, but also trying to build a consensus about what economic growth should be for and what the shared public goods that we all need to drive that kind of growth will be. And so I think paying attention to inequality, it seems like an obscure economic issue, but I think it's a direct, it has a direct impact on the way we think about public goods and what the economy is for and how we grow this state together.
And your report also makes some recommendations as to how to address this, right?
Yeah. So it's probably worth noting, first of all, that this is a national issue, and really the greatest policy levers are national. It's still the case, however, that inside the state, there are things that we could do that would at least push against these trends rather than reinforcing them. And some of those are focused on, you know, the kind of bottom of the labor market and making sure that it's tied in and tied up into growth through minimum wage increases and strong supports for workers and through strong education and skill systems across the board. Like, those things all matter. And then also some of it is should be attentive to the very top end, to tax policy and to making sure that if some people are gaining all the rewards of economic growth, that we at least are building a tax base that allows us to build more inclusive economic structures to help, you know, create an economic opportunity for everyone, not just for the very few. With tax policy, if people at the top of the income distribution are getting all the rewards to growth, then if you're not thinking about that in terms of your tax policy, you can end up running out of resources in the state that are important to building schools that work so people can get decent jobs, building health insurance or child care supports that can help the lower wage workers actually make work for them, et cetera. So you need, you know, so the tax policy issue is sort of one of both raising resources that help support the more inclusive economy and that acknowledge the fact that all the rewards to growth are going up there, and that's where the tax attention needs to go.
Okay. So I'm sorry. Can you list again then some of the things that could be done for the top 1% and the 99%?
Yeah. So then the more focused on the 99% policies are raising and indexing the minimum wage, thinking about the treatment of unions, supporting working families through child care subsidies, making sure health insurance is available through expansion of or strengthening of the Medicaid and Badger Care programs, really focusing on skills and education for working people, the technical college system, a strong, you know, strong education across the board from pre-K through the school, K-12 through the technical colleges and the university system. All that is critical infrastructure for helping the 99% move their incomes forward. And then some of that costs money, and thinking very carefully about tax policy and how to raise the revenue we need to instead of backing out of taxing income for these people who are being rewarded by growth, thinking about how you secure more revenue that way.
From the people who have gained more rewards.
Yeah.
Okay.
Right.
So, devil's advocate then, you know, what would you say to people who have said that if we tax the higher earners, then they won't be able to invest in helping out, you know, the lower wage earners?
I think it's all a question of how much. We have now an economy where all the lion's share of rewards are going to the very, very high end of the income distribution. The way that people have made money in this country is by relying on a public infrastructure that has helped support that, whether that's the schools they went to or the roads they run their goods and services across or whatever. And to think that, you know, there's plenty of incentives for people to make more money to return to tax rates of a, you know, previous, you know, to where they were doesn't erase that incentive. It just helps create a little more fairness in the tax structure.
Again, you are listening to Laura Dresser, Associate Director with the Center on Wisconsin Strategy in Madison. You can find the report online at cows.org. We're going to take a quick break for these announcements, but when we come back, Bayfield's Mary Doherty offers up a few of her favorite recipes from her new cookbook, Life in a Northern Town. I'm Danielle Kading, and you're listening to Hear Me Out on Wisconsin Public Radio.
Hey, I had a bad day, and I wondered how it tastes, so I ate, and then I served myself a second plate.
Hi, I'm Danielle Kading, and you're listening to Hear Me Out on Wisconsin Public Radio. Some of you out there may be planning to grill out or gather around the table this Labor Day weekend, and Bayfield's Mary Doherty has a few recipes that you could try in her new cookbook, Life in a Northern Town. The book melds stories of northern Wisconsin, photos, and recipes featuring locally produced food. She sat down with me in her kitchen recently to talk about the book and her love of food.
We moved up to Bayfield in 2007, and we opened a restaurant in between Washburn and Bayfield. And that kind of got me into the food business, so to speak. And as I was kind of transitioning out of the restaurant, I was looking for something to kind of bring me back into my home kitchen. So I started a blog called The Cookery Maven. And The Cookery Maven just became this series of essays and recipes that looks very similar to the book, that I would go out and do photo safaris with my kids, and we'd take pictures and go in the woods and the waterfalls and the beaches. And then out of that sense of place and that sense of the, you know, our little adventures we were going on, something would pop in my head, like, I think I want to eat sourdough pancakes for dinner, or whatever it was. And then so I just would, it just became this stream of consciousness, kind of like how I view food, that the kitchen is very much knit into my life. I don't separate it from a trip out to Long Island or a trip to Brownstone Falls or a trip to even Duluth. It's all, food is just this prevailing theme, the kind of the thread that weaves everything together in my life.
Okay. And so why do you have such an affinity for cooking then?
Because I figured, this didn't occur to me until much later in life, but if you know how to cook, you will always have a full table. And I love having people around. And that, I think, was, I knew that cooking was a way to meet people. It's how I meet people. It's how I make friends. It's how I cement friendships. It's how I say goodbye. I mean, there's something about the table that I've always, it's a powerful thing when you feed people. And I just love that space of, and it's a really trite thing to say, but food is a way of nurturing and loving the people who are in your life. I mean, we've taken that whole concept of food and love and we've made it kind of ugly because it implies that food is filling a void or you're not really, you know, doing all the work you need to do to find love in other places. But for me, food is, it's how I show people that I love them. I want to know, like, what you like to eat, if I can make it for you, what kind of cakes you want, or if you, you know, what's your favorite meal, because it's the way for me to show affection.
I think that's pretty common for a lot of families, right? Like going home, you know, having your favorite meal or that comfort mm-hmm. food that your parents would cook for you, that sort of thing. Yeah. I think people resonate with that, especially around the holidays.
Yeah, I think that for me, like yesterday, my son Charlie went to, I dropped him off at Conserve School, which is a boarding school kind of over by Rhinelander, Minocqua in Wisconsin. And the first thing that when we knew he was going there, my thought immediately went to, what am I going to make him for his last meal at home? And he knew right away what he wanted, and so I made it for him on Thursday before he left on Friday. But I think that it's food, and I know it's hard, and this is a really complex matter because the world doesn't look like the 50s. We don't have a full-time parent that stays at home that can have dinner on the table at 5. That's not the way the world looks anymore. We have two parents who are working. There's kids in sports. There's school and after-school programs. So it's a much more dynamic and, in my opinion, a more complex situation we're dealing with. But, and we don't have dinner around, and we don't have, you know, eat homemade gnocchi and with a gorgonzola cream sauce every night. Some nights it's, you know, leftover whatever's in the refrigerator and mix it with some eggs, and that counts. But I do think there is value in getting back to using food as that conduit to community, the conduit to create connections. That is hard in the world we live in, but I see the value of it, what it's brought into my life, and I think that it's something we should at least strive for.
Well, and I like how you can see that too in your cookbook, because a lot of the essays that go with the recipes shows how you're connecting with people throughout mm-hmm. northern Wisconsin, whether it's the Oteveros in Mellon or Charlie and Julie Buckles out near Friendly Valley Road. Yeah. You've made all these relationships just on your quest to kind of find the best local food, it seems like.
Or just, yeah, because food, for me, like I said, food is my entree. It's how I move through the world is, what do you like to eat? What are you growing? Tell me what you think about A, B, or C. And so it's where I'm interested. It's what I'm interested in. So, of course, I'd be like, well, where do you get your beef from? Or I really like, there's a recipe in the cookbook for corn dogs, and I'm very particular about hot dogs. And so I was asking someone, does anyone make local hot dogs up here? And that's how I got to know the Oteveros and Mellon. Because I like a really good beef hot dog with just enough, like not too much salt, but enough spice in it. And then a really good snap. Because have you eaten corn dogs?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Nothing grosser than having a corn dog that doesn't have, I don't like corn dogs that don't have a natural skin casing. Because then it's just like you don't know when you go through the breading and get to the meat. It just all kind of blends together. So the Oteveros had my perfect corn dog hot dogs.
Well, and that's like the other thing I like about your cookbook, because there's all these kind of iconic pieces of northern Wisconsin in it, like the corn man.
Mm-hmm. Oh my God, the corn man. I know. I follow the corn man on Facebook, if you can believe that. And so when he got here last week, we made sure to get there on the first day that he was here, because corn man corn is the best. And yeah, I mean, that's what I think makes this area kind of cool. And I hope that the book reflects that, is that Bayfield is more than just sailboats and kayaking. This Bayfield community, this Bayfield region, extends far down into the Shawamigan, past the Shawamigan Bay, and into, you know, down near Mellon and over to the east, over, you know, in Iron County. There's a lot of, we live in a really diverse, vibrant community. And it's the sailboats and the kayaking, and that's great. The Powell Islands are beautiful, but there's a lot of really cool people that are doing some pretty amazing things just because that's how they've chosen to live. They're not doing it to get attention or to leverage it in any way. It's just we've all chosen to do the things that make us happy, and I feel very fortunate to be welcomed into as many people's homes and kitchens as I have been.
And just for any listeners who may not know, the corn man has gotten a reputation in the area for selling the best sweet corn in Ashland from, like, the back of his truck the side of the highway.
I know. My husband, Ted, grew up in Cumberland, and that's where the corn man's from. And I remember going to Ted's cabin when I was in my early 20s and seeing Bob's Baronet corn parked at the Quick Trip or whatever they had there. And then when I came up here, I was like, oh, my God, Baronet Bob is what we used to call him. He was up here. And then I don't think we ever even bought his corn when we lived in Cumberland, or when we go to Cumberland. But now the arrival of Corn Man is kind of something to be paid attention to.
It's like a hallmark of summer.
Totally. Like, yay, it's August, Corn Man's here.
Well, you've laid out this book in seasons. So you kind of go spring, summer, fall, winter. Mm. And I'm guessing that all of the recipes kind of go along with that.
Yeah. I've never written a book before, and I'm not exactly, I don't, like I've said earlier, I'm not a very linear person. So thank God for my editor, Kate Thompson, at the Wisconsin Historical Press. When I submitted my manuscript, it was just kind of like my blog. It was stream of consciousness, like here's something about a waterfall, then here's corn dog, and then, oh, look, there's some sassy nanny goat cheese, and then, look, we went to the beach. It was, you know, but when she put it together, that's why I was saying editors are magic. I don't know. I mean, she just provided, I gave her a lot of good raw material. I'm not saying that, but she provided structure that I think the book flows really, really well.
Well, I just think it makes sense when certain food is in season, you know, to have recipes that reflect that. But then also, you know, I was looking through some of the winter sections, and you have pictures of the ice caves and stories to go with that about the ice road and just some really good hearty food recipes for when it's really cold in northern Wisconsin.
Yeah. I cannot wait to get, I'm getting a little sick. I mean, the tomatoes are just coming in, so I'm happy, but I was going through the cookbook last night looking for something, and there's a recipe in there for this venison stew, and I was like, oh God, I can't wait till it gets cold enough that I can turn on my oven.
And I have to admit, when I saw the Long Island on skis, I thought, oh, here's a new mix for Long Island drinks that I can try instead of it being a story about skiing to Long Island.
We did drink tequila that day, though. We were drinking, I think we were drinking the Sugar Bush Margarita, actually. I don't remember. But yeah, you could not ski to Long Island after drinking Long Island cocktails. It's really far.
That would be a little bit hard to stay on your skis.
Yeah, no kidding. It's just all like rail liquor too. Those things will kill you. You shouldn't drink those. When I was a bartender, I didn't know how to make them. And so I asked the person who ordered it, and he's like, you just take every single liquor. Do you know what that's what it is? Yes. And then Coke.
Yeah.
It's like a bomb for your like, your blood sugar. It's like, boom. Yeah, so that was another thing. Like just who gets to get on skis and ski across Lake Superior to go have lunch at Long Island? I've tried not to get numb to the technicolor beauty up here, but this doesn't look like the rest of the world. I mean, when you go to the beach on the day when the sun is just bright and that water's deep blue and you're out at Devils or at Stockton where the cliff, you know, I mean, there's a lot of color, a lot of vibrancy that you just don't get in the city. And I think that we kind of wanted to pull that vibrancy of our natural world and kind of extract the vibrancy of our community. Because I think the community tends to reflect place. There is a relationship there, just like food reflects place. And so I wanted to translate my love of this place through the stories of the folks that I've met that are perfect ambassadors of this place, this vibrancy, this kind of, I would say you can hear the earth's heartbeat here better than you can in other places.
So what are some of your favorite stories in the cookbook then?
There was, oh, you know what the one I do really like is this one that, oh God, when William and I got lost, we were driving to, I'm trying to find Foster Falls or something, I can't remember. But I hate asking for directions. I hate it, and I refuse to ask for directions. And we're completely lost. There's no cell phone coverage in Iron County. And we're driving around, and George, that big yellow dog, is like bouncing around the car. William's playing super annoying music before he got to have better taste in music. And we're just driving. We couldn't find this damn place. Oh, it's Spring Camp Falls. And we drove. I saw this old guy on the side of the road, and I just said, hey, do you know where it is? We're looking for Spring Camp Falls. And we would, you know, we'd gone past the entrance probably four times at that point. But there's in that essay, I had read something from Wendell Berry a couple days before we left. And he said something about impeded waters are the ones that sing or something like that. You know, if you find your true path when you have no idea what on earth you're doing. When you're in that space of tension, that space of not knowing what's next, that's when you're doing your real work. And I remember thinking, after having read Barry's words and doing this thing with Will, we're driving around and I was getting frustrated and he's like, where are we? And the dog's jumping all over. When we got to Spring Camp Falls and I saw Charlie, who was my son, who was probably 10 at the time, bent over this pile of moss, taking pictures of it. And I saw Will trying to capture the water coming down the chute of the waterfall. And I just realized all that driving around and all that, you know, trying to figure out where the hell we were, it got us to that point with those, like, because in a life you don't get, not everything is a Hallmark moment. And sometimes those Hallmark moments, they come between some pretty hard stuff. And not that ride was hard, but that essay reminds me that to realize that sometimes where I'm headed isn't where I think it is, but it might be, and largely is, 100 times better than my planned destination.
And so what are you hoping that people take away from your book?
I want people to take away the fact that we need to keep food. I'd like to see food to be brought back into context. What I mean by that is that it's not about the food looking like an Instagram post. It's not about the food wowing somebody because you're able to make this amazing bechamel sauce that goes on perfectly cooked piece of beef. Always, I mean, food is the price of admission for me to family and to friends and to community. It's a way to bring people in. And so what I said in the introduction is true. Like, I was trying to replicate these canned potatoes that my grandmother had made. And I had no idea they were canned potatoes. I thought it was blasphemy to say that Grandma Duffy would serve her family canned potatoes, because she was, like, we went to her house every Sunday for dinner. It was a very treasured part of my childhood. And then I found out that they were canned potatoes, and I was like, you gotta be kidding me. And then I realized, it made me think, like, that it was not about the canned. I wasn't trying to replicate the canned potatoes. I was wanted to go back to what it felt to be at a table among your family, with people that you love and that you're talking and you're listening. As a kid, you're mostly listening. That all food comes from some place, and that place is someone's home, and it's all connected. The food that is prepared in my house and how that makes people feel around my table, how it's grown, comes from someone else's house. And how does that food help them love their home, or be proud of their home, or be safe in their home? Putting food back in context and not removing it, because I think when we remove food from us, from the human aspect and the natural world aspect, that we allow space for dysfunction. And we put it back in its space. Like, for instance, with the cooking class, what I did here last week with a bunch of great women from all over Wisconsin, and there's a kind of weird stage fright when you go to prepare food and I can appreciate that, but, you know, everyone's like, well, do you know how, they want to talk about knife skills. I'm like, just cut the food. It doesn't really matter. Like, don't cut your fingers off, obviously, be safe, but you don't need to do like some jiu-jitsu knife skills to make a really great watermelon gazpacho. Just chop it up.
Okay, so recipes that people absolutely have to try from this cookbook.
The Moroccan cheese ball. I love that thing. I think everyone needs a cheese ball. And I know it sounds crazy, but let's say it's Wednesday and you, through a fit of beautiful enthusiasm, you're like, you should come over for drinks tomorrow night because, you know, I really miss you. And then you get home from work on Thursday and you're like, oh my God, people are coming for drinks and I have nothing to serve them. Cheese balls are super easy. It's just cream cheese and goat cheese. Stick it in your food processor and then make it into a little ball and give it with crackers. People love it.
And not so crazy for northern Wisconsin, or Wisconsin anywhere.
Well, it's Moroccan, so it's a little funky. So I wanted, because, you know, I wasn't going to do like an ordinary cheese ball. Yeah, you can do whatever. Cheese ball is a blank canvas. You can do whatever. Cheese ball is a permission and a blank canvas to be as creative as you want. But I went the Moroccan route because I love Moroccan food. But that one, and then, I don't know, what do you think?
I don't know. I was looking at a lot of them, and I noticed a lot with chutney, which I have never done anything with.
That's super easy. Chutney is just basically baked fruit, or, you know, sautéed fruit. Oh, you know, also the gorgonzola cheesecake's really good. And the gnocchi. I made gnocchi last night. Gnocchi is just a wonderful thing to make. People should try it. Do not be scared of making gnocchi. The first time you make it, it might get a little funky the first couple times. But once you figure out the consistency, there is nothing like putting it. Literally, last night I had people over and I had them come over and feel the gnocchi because it feels like little clouds. Yeah, gnocchi is a beautiful thing to make, and it's really easy once you get the hang of it.
Well, and I think I cornered one of the pages for a mac and cheese recipe.
Yep, that's Will, my son Will's favorite recipe. That one I would not use homemade gnocchi to make that mac and cheese because I've done it. You can get gnocchi up here. Made by Scotty Picotti. He makes gnocchi out of Hurley. And they have it at other places. But it's a nice, firm gnocchi. And if you make the homemade gnocchi, is a little bit too pillowy. It needs the frozen gnocchi does a little bit better. And plus, you don't want to make mac and cheese with homemade gnocchi. It is such a beautiful thing. You want it to, like, be on its own and stand very proudly in its roasted tomato sauce.
It feels like combining so many extravagant things together that you'd probably end up going into a coma right after dinner.
I know. After looking at all the food in this cookbook, I'm like, I think there is definitely a hedonistic part of me. Like, I definitely do tend towards excess. But it's fun. Like, God, I mean, I looked at, there's like butter and cream and pancetta and gluten everywhere, but it's really good. And we don't eat like that all the time. But when I think if you're going to take the time to make a meal, make it something that you really want to eat.
Anything for those who are allergic to gluten or are of the vegan variety?
By mistake, I made a vegan cookie. And I didn't realize it was vegan until I was testing it. But it's actually, it's a, because I wanted to do an olive oil cookie. I thought it'd be cool to make an olive oil cookie because I love the taste of really good, you know, Greek olive oil. And I was testing the recipe, and I had to get rid of the eggs. And then I thought, oh my God, I actually, Mary Doherty made a vegan recipe, which was like crazy because I do not tell, you know, I couldn't, I love butter. I love it so much. I can't even tell you how much I love butter. And so, but they're really good cookies. And then you, then those, they're little thumbprint cookies and you put this blood orange marmalade in it. And it's really nice for, winter, you know, when blood oranges are out.
Well, anything else that you want to add about your cookbook?
That food isn't what, back to what I said earlier, food isn't what we should strive for. It's, we should strive to bring food back into that fabric and give it its right space, knowing that there's consequences for how you eat, where your food comes from, and they're not all bad. You know, there's, you can create, a lot of change happens around the table, and that's what I think is important.
And next year you might be inviting people into your table so you can teach them how to cook.
Indeed, that's going to be fun. I used to do cooking classes years ago with just friends, and they weren't exactly organized, but a friend of mine on the island, she had some yoga retreat folks up, and they came over last week and we did a cooking class, and I realized how much I missed that, is just having people that I don't, it's back kind of back to the restaurant days where meeting people and creating that connection and just teaching people what I know, but also listening to what they know and having this crazy alchemy that happens in a kitchen. It doesn't, like, the cookbook's just a place to start. Recipes are just a place to start. You should absolutely make it look like how it needs to look in your kitchen. And that is, you need to, you know, that means you have to listen to what your family wants, what your friends, what, who if you're having for dinner, you don't like cilantro, so you don't put that in there, or you think you hate thyme, so you're going to use rosemary, or it, that happens when I have people in here and we're all creating, we're co-creating a meal together.
Again, you are listening to Bayfield's Mary Doherty about her new cookbook, Life in a Northern Town. It's available at local bookstores and online. Doherty is also holding a book signing this weekend at the Madeline Island Museum from 1 to 3 on Saturday afternoon. We're going to take a short break for these announcements, but when we come back, we'll review news of the week as covered by the Superior Bureau. I'm Danielle Kading, and you're listening to Hear Me Out on Wisconsin Public Radio. Lonely tastes like bread, but toast can make a loyal friend. Hi, I'm Danielle Kading, and this is Hear Me Out on Wisconsin Public Radio. And up next, it's the news of the week, as covered by the KUWS news team. Volunteers from Wisconsin are lending a hand with disaster response after Hurricane Harvey flooded Texas and the Gulf Coast this week. After 20 years with the American Red Cross, Kyle Kriegel says the damage from Harvey is similar to the devastation caused by Hurricane Katrina.
I know that several folks have been calling in that are current volunteers. We're trying to get them deployed as quickly as we can. These are folks that are going to be helping with sheltering, feeding, and helping those folks that are have been evacuated from those areas of flooding.
Kriegel says the Red Cross has been seeking to fill 1,700 positions nationwide to help with disaster response. More than 90 people from Wisconsin have been helping to find food and shelter for people affected by the storm. Six protesters were arrested Tuesday at a construction site for Enbridge Energy's Line 3 replacement project south of Superior. The line carries up to 390,000 barrels per day from Canada to its Superior terminal. Protesters streamed live video from the site for about an hour before they were arrested. In the video, two protesters are sitting on equipment being used to replace a segment of Enbridge's 1960s-era pipeline. One of them can be heard here speaking to a Douglas County Sheriff's deputy.
This can't go through.
So I'm formally telling you, you guys need to leave. You're trespassing. You can't be on equipment.
Douglas County Sheriff Tom Dahlbeck says he previously warned the group not to trespass on the site.
Obviously, they didn't heed my warning or my advice, and
They were subsequently arrested for trespassing.
Dahlbeck says he's not aware of any injuries from the incident. Three of the six are being held without bond. Enbridge spokeswoman Becky Hazy says they contacted the Douglas County Sheriff's Office to make arrests.
We always recognize people's right to protest, and we want to encourage dialogue with the community and make sure that people's voices are getting heard. What we don't want and will not tolerate is potentially dangerous situations for individuals and our construction workers.
Tribal and environmental groups have put out an appeal for donations to raise bail money for those who were arrested. Paul DeMaine with news from Indian Country says groups in Minnesota and Wisconsin are upset over the ongoing project.
Line 3 isn't permitted in Minnesota. Enbridge already has its pipeline stacked on site. They're already constructing it, so they're acting like Line 3 is going to go in no matter what.
Despite temporary disruptions, Enbridge says the Wisconsin portion of the Line 3 replacement project is on schedule. It's slated to be complete by early winter. In the last 2 weeks, people have been protesting the replacement of Enbridge Energy's Line 3 pipeline. But on Saturday, a group of people will hold a lacrosse game at a site where Enbridge's Line 5 pipeline runs through Bayfield County. That pipeline carries up to 540,000 barrels of oil and natural gas from Superior to Sarnia, Canada. Ashland resident Frank Kane is one of the event's organizers. Kane says Enbridge is seeking a renewal of a special use permit to maintain Line 5 on a roughly 12-mile stretch running through national forest land. But Kane says the permit expired several years ago.
And now they want to just use the same old rules and replace it. And we're saying, no, the Forest Service needs to step in and say you need to do a new EIS. Technologies have changed, equipment has changed, the world has changed in the last 50 years.
Officials with the U.S. Forest Service and Enbridge have said the company submitted all the necessary paperwork to renew the permit before it expired, but a backlog prevented the federal agency from reviewing it sooner. Kane says they're inviting people to view the site for themselves.
Having people to come out and pick some berries, we're going to talk about lacrosse. And if enough people show up, we will do some lacrosse demonstrations.
Redcliffe member Sandy Goki says she's a mother and water protector. Goki says lacrosse was given to Anishinaabe people to help heal the body and spirit.
And also it's used to resolve conflicts. So I figure what better way to heal our Mother Earth and to resolve this conflict between us Anishinaabe and Enbridge than to play our game.
Goki says the pipeline crosses through territory where tribes practice treaty rights to hunt and gather.
This is our land. We have rights, and they're putting my kids' water, my kids' deer meat, and their grandkids, they're putting all of that at risk.
A spokeswoman with Enbridge released a statement about the event on Saturday saying, quote, "Our hope is that all protest activity remains lawful and peaceful, and that we are given opportunities to engage in meaningful discussion to resolve our differences." Kane says he doesn't anticipate any unlawful activity on Saturday. The event will begin at noon on Saturday with a ceremony and potluck, and it'll be held at Forest Road 237 in Bayfield County. Wisconsin U.S. Senator Tammy Baldwin made a stop at Faradine Outdoors in Superior this week. The Democratic lawmaker is touting a bill she introduced earlier this month that would allow more investment in research and development for small and medium-sized businesses.
This is all that R&D stuff you're talking about?
Yeah.
This is it in action.
Faradine Vice President of Operations Craig Tinsley is showing Senator Tammy Baldwin the production floor of the outdoor products manufacturing facility. Tinsley says the company produces targets and archery equipment for 18 different brands.
We make a whole wide range of products, everything from have to do with archery. We have a product line that has binocular holders for bird watching, bird viewing, tripods for your phones, for your bike, a bike mount for your cell phone to put on your bike or what have you. So we're pretty diverse.
Tinsley says they want to grow to become a one-stop shop for customers like outdoor stores, Dunham's, and Cabela's. He says they're making efforts to streamline production in order to reach that goal. Senator Baldwin introduced a bill earlier this month that would make it easier for businesses like Faradine to do just that. The legislation allows companies easier access to a research and development tax credit. Baldwin says it would also count efforts to streamline production as a research expense.
So in our tour at Fairdyne here today, I was hearing about all sorts of ways in which employees have been given the task of redesigning the production process in ways that are more efficient and less costly.
Baldwin says the bill would also encourage manufacturers to invest in new technology. A high-tech machine called a super mini mill carves a part for one of their products out of a block of aluminum. Fairdyne bought the equipment last year. Tinsley says it allows them to put a prototype of a product design together within hours.
You go through multiple changes and multiple variations of a new idea. Well, being able to make those changes on the fly helps us be more competitive, keeps our costs down, and plus we're quicker to market.
The process to apply for the tax credit and comply with rules for receiving it proves too costly for the company right now. Tinsley says he hopes the proposed reforms go through as they look to create 75 new products this year. A shuttered ski resort in Cable may come under new ownership. As Elizabeth McMahon reports, HK Hospitality wants to invest about $47 million to reopen Telemark year-round.
Telemark Lodge is a skiing landmark in Cable. The property has long been the starting site of the American Birkebeiner ski race. The lodge has faced financial trouble for decades. Current owner Mount Telemark Partners bought the building at a sheriff's auction 4 years ago. James Bolin is the director for the Cable Area Chamber of Commerce. Bolin says the sale would be a boon for the community.
It would bring significant revenue in terms of room tax for marketing dollars for the area, in terms of visitor spending. I think they're estimating about $25 million in direct visitor spending annually from the revitalized project. And so that's a welcome thing for the businesses in the area.
Jim Kelly is the managing partner of HK Hospitality. Kelly says they've been working on a deal with the owners to buy the property. The lodge would retain many of the Telemark's iconic features, but he says guest wings would be torn down and rebuilt.
We will reopen the ski resort. We're going to continue to host the American Birkebeiner, or the Birky as it's called, which is the largest cross-country ski event in America. We're opening the downhill slopes. We're adding a chalet. We are going to either partner or purchase the adjoining golf course and the one over on Spider Lake with some lakefront property. And we're going to expand all the services for year-round.
A feasibility study will be completed to determine whether Telemark would be successful if reopened. The Bayfield County Board voted to contribute $11,250 for the study. County Administrator Mark Abels Allison said in an email that he is confident new developments would be successful and create jobs. Kelly with HK Hospitality says if the deal goes through, they could begin remodeling the lodge this winter. Elizabeth McMahon, Wisconsin Public Radio.
WITC students are going back to school this week in Superior, and as Elizabeth McMahon reports, student enrollment is up.
WITC in Superior is seeing a surge in student enrollment this semester. Jessica Heer is the Marketing and Public Relations Associate for WITC in Superior. She says new student enrollment is up about 5% from last year, with 250 new students attending this fall. Heer says their degree programs are driving the increase.
Our programs are designed to meet the need of employers in our area. And so students enrolling at WITC know that they're going into a program that is designed to fit the needs of employers and allow them to get right into the workplace. We have a very high job placement rate, and students will very clearly see the return on their investment in a very short period of time.
Heer says welding, trade, medical assistant, and nursing programs are the most sought-after degrees. She says a total of 380 students have enrolled at WITC in Superior this fall. Elizabeth McMahon, Wisconsin Public Radio.
And UW-Superior is getting ready for students heading back to campus next week. Elizabeth McMahon reports on the university's so-called Weekend of Welcome events.
UW-Superior has been holding events to welcome new students to campus for more than 25 years. This year, more than 300 new freshmen and transfer students will take part in the university's Weekend of Welcome, or WOW, events to kick off the 2017-2018 academic year. Jen Bird is the Director of First Year Experience at UWS.
And the new student celebration is when they're first stepping in. So students are coming in, they're learning about our history, our traditions. They're hearing from current students and faculty. And then they're also doing a new student pledge. So they're kind of pledging to, you know, take responsibility for their education. And we're really just celebrating them being here and formally kind of welcoming them as a campus.
Bird says they'll hold a number of activities during the week, including educational sessions.
We also do some stuff about, it's called Sex Signals, and it's about like healthy relationships and avoiding sexual assaults and things like that. So there's kind of a wide variety of things where it's a balance of social and educational.
The weekend of events will also include a hypnotist, black party, and games across campus. Elizabeth McMahon, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Events for UW Superior's Weekend of Welcome will be held from today through Sunday, September 3rd. This has been Wisconsin Public Radio's Weekend Review, as covered by the KUWS News team. And that's it for our program. You can hear it again online on our website at wpr.org/superior. You've been listening to Hear Me Out on Wisconsin Public Radio. We hope to have you back with us again next Friday. Until then, have a great Labor Day weekend.